It seems like just yesterday we couldn't go a week without some new article or video making the rounds about new workers called millennials who are just beginning to join the workforce. How to attract millennials, their strengths and assets, or quite often, just how to put up with them. A YouTube search still turns up thousands of videos on the subject, including this one.
You've survived your company's most recent downsizing. Hooray. Now, for the bad news. They've all been replaced by millennials. Oh, sweet Jesus, that surely means more work for you. But don't panic. As the saying goes, if you can't join them, beat them. Or something like that.
That's violent. Well, it's hard to believe, but millennials are getting to be valued team members with experience, and now companies are starting to reimagine benefits, work culture, and incentives in terms of what Generation Z wants. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to hear what the incoming workers expect and value and how that's different from past generations, from millennials way on up. My first guest is Tess Serpronaut. She's the Director of Career Services at UMKC. Hi, Tess.
Hello.
So Gen Z is people born in 1997 or later, which means that the older generation, the older end of that generation is 22. Mm-hmm. And 22-year-olds are often finishing college looking for jobs.
Exactly.
So 1997, I understand that the logic behind that year defining a new generation is that kids born in 1997 would have had the digital immersion we live with now from the very start. Do you see that affecting the kind of worker you would expect this generation to be?
Oh, absolutely. I think we see it in a lot of ways. I think that for starters, this is a group that's always had a smartphone. And this is a group that has had, you know, hundreds or thousands of marketing messages presented to them every day. So they're pretty savvy about that. They're they're used to a lot of information. And I know that one of the areas that we recently saw sort of a clash between employers and students is students really want a job description that sells the job to them, that markets the job to them. And employers tend to write, especially for entry-level positions, really sort of bare bones, simplistic, here's what we're looking for. And those just types of things aren't cutting it with this generation.
Because this generation is used to so aggressively being courted by
everything.
Commercial products.
Right. And everything, really.
As you talk to young people in this age group, do you notice a difference in what Gen Zers want and expect or maybe worry about as they consider possible career trajectories, or maybe what they don't want or don't worry about?
Absolutely. So I've been doing career services for 16 years, and I've been working myself much longer than that. Definitely things have changed in the 16 years that I've been doing this. When I started and I was dealing with millennials, I would do a survey every year of, if you have multiple offers, what are the things that would sway you to choose one company or one offer over another? And for years, access to being given a company iPhone and access to the internet and Facebook came up really like one in two for what students really wanted in a job.
That super depresses me.
Yeah, doesn't it? So
want but, more, everybody. Want more.
Well, I thought so too. Benefits, salary, 401. But that's not necessarily what was important to them at that time. But at that time, iPhones were brand new and Facebook was brand new. And these were really top of mind for that generation. Now, if we do a survey, those things don't even come up. Everybody's already got a phone and they don't need the company to give them one. And everybody
has access to that free thing is not really super important to people anymore.
Yeah, so exactly. So now we're seeing things like unlimited vacation.
Unlimited?
Unlimited. There's companies that offer supposedly unlimited vacation.
How does that
policy
work?
Is we have no policy. Well, in theory, you know, from a student's perspective, they hear this and they think, I can just call up any old day and say, I feel like taking a vacation day today. But of course, that's not really what the the company's thinking.
What is the company?
The company is thinking, you know, it's hard to track and monitor these things. You can take vacation with your manager's approval, and you know whether you take.
But then you can't without it.
But you can't without it.
Okay, so it's just sort of an interpersonal negotiation on some level.
Right, but how it's marketed is different than that, and how it's perceived by this generation is.
Yeah, the word unlimited is very marketing-y.
Yes.
So that kind of tracks with what you were saying before.
Absolutely. And I think in those cases, those companies are pretty savvy about understanding what's a hot button for this generation.
What else other than unlimited vacation, which does sound nice?
It does sound nice. I think it sounds fantastic. But I think, and interestingly enough, this is a generation that's looking for stability more than millennials. And I think one of the reasons for that is that this is a generation that we're probably about 12 years old at the time the financial crisis hit. And they might have lived through parents who lost their jobs. They might have lived through, you know, having their house foreclosed upon. And so for them, this is a generation that, you know, they don't want to go through that themselves.
Yeah, my dad grew up in the Great Depression, and I always thought that really influenced sort of his attitude toward financial things long when that was way over.
Right,
but
exactly.
You're kind of saying this
it sort
is another
of leaves scars that you live with forever.
So another Depression era generation on some level.
Yeah, and they also say this is a generation that's more hesitant to invest in the stock market, or that they project will be, that they're more, I'm going to have my money hidden
under
in
my
a
mattress.
So I think that the idea of stability and being able to stay with a company and grow with a company that won't lay them off is a big thing. And mentorship and access to senior management, I think, is another thing that we see a lot.
Explain that. Access to senior management. I don't know that I would have even thought to want that at that age.
I don't think.
I mean, I think I would have if I had known to think about it. But
it wouldn't have even occurred to me that as I'm being hired for an entry level position, that I would have that there would be an open door policy that I could go and talk to a VP or the president of the company. This is a generation that kind of sees management structure as being quite flat, and they should have access to it and mentorship.
Really, you have college students talking to you about someday I'd like to start a job where I can walk into the door of the president of the company's office from day one. That's like a conversation you're having with college students.
I have conversations with college students who say, I don't want to work in a hierarchical organization where I can't go and talk to the president.
Good for them, honestly.
Yeah, unless you're bumping up against some baby boomers who think that, you know, I've worked hard to get access to the C-suite, and who
don't
do you
go
think
over my head.
You don't go over my head. So it can cause some conflicts.
I'd imagine, speaking of baby boomers, that an aging baby boomer workforce puts some pressure on companies to think about making themselves attractive and relevant to, like, the young blood in a way that they didn't really have to think about when people my age were new on the scene. I mean, I definitely think we needed employers more than they needed us in the early aughts. Do you see that changing?
Yeah, I think a lot of companies are worrying about their aging workforce and replacing them. And I know here in Kansas City, talent attraction is a huge issue, and talent retention.
A municipal issue, not even just an issue for a specific business.
Right. But I think specific businesses are looking at this also. So I do think that it's a big issue. And we saw companies really changing and adapting to a millennial population and offering benefits and programs that met millennial needs. And it'll be interesting to see how they change those and tweak those programs to meet a changing generation.
How has the way you talk to students about finding jobs changed?
So we're kind of on a cusp. So we have a generation that's really just coming to that point of looking for jobs now and wanting things. But we don't have companies that are completely there to accommodate them yet. So to a certain extent, you can ask for what you want. You can negotiate things, but understand that you might not get everything that you want, or you might not get it from the minute you walk in the door for that first job. But you can be part of what changes it. And I know one of the things I hear from students all the time is, I want to negotiate being able to work from home and flexible hours, and that's what I really want in a job. And my advice is don't necessarily say that in an interview.
Yeah, you're selling yourself in the interview.
So because what a baby boomer hears when or even a Gen X or even a millennial, when you say things like that, they think, oh, this person doesn't want to work. They're already trying to figure out how they can work less.
They're looking for someone they can count on.
Yeah. So go prove yourself. Show that you're a good, solid worker, that they can trust you. And then most organizations are willing to accommodate working from home if you've shown that you're a reliable employee, but probably they're not going to be interested in talking about that at the end of a one-hour interview, and they don't know you yet.
It's so interesting, though, when I think about working from home, which I have done, when I was very early in my career, and I kind of craved having that office environment, not because I love offices. I don't love offices. But I lived in small spaces and couldn't really – I mean – it's not like I was living in a luxurious home. I was 22, you know. I wanted a space that was set up. That was an appealing thing.
You know, I don't want to sound like I'm an old fuddy-duddy or anything like that, but sometimes I think they ask these things and talk about these things because they've heard it and they feel like they should be asking about these things, but they haven't fully sort of visualized what it looks like. I've worked from home and jobs, and it gets really lonely.
And you have to buy a printer.
You do.
I don't want to buy a printer, ever.
And, you know, you have to have multiple screens, and you have to have things set up. But the worst of it for me was it's lonely. You have no coworkers. You know, so much of what makes a work
environment great.
Maybe
that's why access to Facebook was so important.
Back in the day, yes. Yeah, so I think it's just interesting because the same student who might be talking about I want to work from home and I want flexible hours also talks about the importance of culture and having an environment that really builds and nurtures their career, and sometimes that might be at odds if you're working remotely.
Yeah. So is this on some level about values or is it about things like economic pressures that sort of pushes these kinds of changes?
I think it's both. I definitely think that we hear more about values. And it kind of pains me a little bit because I don't think that there's any generation, baby boomers on, who thought, I don't care about the organization or what they stand for or what they mean. I just want a paycheck. I think most people have always wanted to work someplace where they believe in it. But I think that this generation is very vocal about that's something that's really important to them. And I do think it drives some of their decisions.
I understand that you have a recent advisee who started working at the Google headquarters.
You
had a visit that was sort of illuminating to you.
Yeah, so I visited one of my former students at the Google headquarters, and I was talking to him about how we get more students there. And he took me to lunch right on campus, which wasn't really all that generous of them because all of their restaurants are free, and so there's no cost incurred. And so they have multiple restaurants right there on the campus. You can go, you just order what you want. We happened to go to a sit-down restaurant. A waiter came, took our order, and then at the end, we just walked away. It's like dining and dashing, but legitimately. But he was talking about all the benefits that they have. You can bring your dog to work. You can wear pajamas. You have free food everywhere. There's little kitchen set up near your office, and at the kitchen closest to your desk, you can request that if your favorite snack food is cherry Pop-Tarts, it'll be stocked with cherry Pop-Tarts. But he said that it's nice, and they're wonderful benefits, and they're great for attracting new recruits. But the other side of it is that there's no reason to leave. So if you bring your dog to work, that means if you have a dog and you leave your dog at home, at some point you have to leave the office to go home and let your dog out. Otherwise, you've got a problem. But if your dog's with you, you just take your dog on a little walk.
Yeah, I don't need to leave work for lunch. I don't need to leave work.
Right.
To
and
take
he was
care
saying that what
dog.
They, you know, if in Mountain View, if you're working there and you want to leave the campus for lunch, by the time you get to your car and drive to a restaurant, you've eaten up a lot of time. Now you sit at a restaurant and eat and maybe run a couple errands. Chances are your lunch is going to go over an hour. If you eat on campus, you're probably eating with your coworkers. You're talking about work.
Never leave.
And in a half an hour, you go back to your desk and you're productive. So a lot of the benefits, while they're true benefits and people love them, there's still this idea that...
Is there still a world outside of work? Yeah. Well, call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation. What generation are you a part of? What is or was important to you as you began to search out the right field or the right employer? Do you think the cultural or economic forces acting on you at that time had something to do with that? Or if you're doing that search now, have something to do with it? 816-235-2888 to join this conversation. I'd like to bring in our next guest. Stephanie Smithmeyer is a recruiting consultant at Morgan Hunter. They specialize in job placement, recruiting, headhunting. Would it be fair to say you're like a matchmaker between prospective workers and employers?
Absolutely. A matchmaker, a broker, whatever you want to call us.
What are some of the big shifts you've seen, whether they've already come up or other things that haven't come up yet?
You know, companies are constantly reviewing what they have to offer right now. And they're trying to keep up with the new generations. And, you know, what do we need to be doing to attract and retain talent? And, you know, a lot of what you guys were just talking about is definitely resounding in, you know, every generation of job seekers right now and every employer out there in Kansas City that's looking to hire. You know, the things that have always been important to people, those, you know, competitive and affordable benefits, they're still very important to people. But companies are having to diversify what they're offering. You know, what does that mean? That means, you know, we've seen a shift to, you know, it used to be your low deductible PPOs. It's now your high deductible HSAs. But what it's giving employees is the opportunity to have that additional savings account. You know, with a lower premium. So it's saving more money in their pocket. So that's an added benefit to them, less cost, you know, more money that they're bringing home. Hands down, the biggest benefit that companies are constantly trying to offer is flexibility. And what does flexibility mean? Because I think for every generation out there, flexibility doesn't mean the same thing to everyone or even to each individual.
Can you tease that out a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I'll just give you a few examples of what some companies are currently doing. You know, there's the flexible hours. There's the condensed schedules. Summer hours. There's some companies in town that have extended their summer hours, meaning off at noon on Fridays or off every Friday to year-round. The ability to work from home, you guys were just talking about that. And that's not something necessarily that means the same thing to everyone either. Because maybe it's working from home, but maybe it's, you know, hey, I need to clear my head and go down to the coffee shop and work for a while. A company that can actually give them the tools and the technology to be able to do that. To be able to have that, you know. work, you know, workforce mobility, really.
We'll pick right back up with this conversation in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about how approaches to recruiting and retaining new employees have changed over generations. Is that because of what companies can provide, or is it more the changing values and needs of the incoming workforce? Call 816-235-2888 with your story. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about recruiting and retaining Gen Z, that is, the workforce born in or after 1997. Yes, indeed, they are ready to start careers. And what they want and expect is different from what millennials, Gen Xers, and baby boomers wanted. Maybe fairly similar to what they want now, honestly, but as they enter the workforce, they already want things that a lot of us did not think to want back when we were that age. What they value, though, may also be different, and that is already shaping how businesses think about incentives and benefits and all kinds of things. My guests are Tess Serpernot, with us from the Career Services at UMKC, and Stephanie Smithmeyer of the recruiting firm Morgan Hunter. Hi again, you two.
Hello.
Good morning.
Stephanie, you were just saying that flexibility is important across the board right now to workers, doesn't matter what generation you're in, but that we all define flexibility differently. And you were saying one example of that would be, what do you mean when you say you want to work from home? Can you give other examples of how we're all interpreting flexibility just a little bit differently depending on either where we are in life or what generation we came up in?
Yeah, absolutely. The younger generation, you know, maybe what's important to them is their new puppy that they just got, you know, and they want to be able to, get home to be able to let that puppy out. So maybe their schedule needs to be shifted just a little bit. Or maybe it's that sports team that they joined, that rec league, that they have games on Tuesday nights that, you know, they need to leave a little bit early for.
This has always been true. I think what is new is that people maybe feel empowered to say that out loud to their bosses. Like, I feel like I did have a dog that I needed to walk when I was just starting at work, and I would go home and do that over lunch sometimes.
Sure.
Or I would hurry home late or early, hopefully after work, to do that sometimes.
Right.
But I don't think I would have felt comfortable expressing that as a need.
And I think it's employers being more aware. I think it's employers actually taking the time to survey their staff and know what's important to them. And those are the employers that are actually attracting the talent and retaining the talent. And, I recently went to a conference earlier this year, and it was a kind of a staggering statistic to learn that 66% of the workforce is unengaged. And to me, that means...
Unengaged meaning?
In their job. And that means, you know, there's companies out there because there's the talent scarcity right now. There's so many companies looking to hire that people know that it's a job seeker's market. They're aware of that. It's a huge topic right now. And because employees and job seekers have that leverage, I think the reason why they're speaking up is because they know they have the leverage. They know that their talents and skills are needed.
Let's bring our callers in on this. You can join the conversation at 816-235-2888 or tweet us your story. We are at KCURCST. I want to talk to Leslie. Leslie is calling us from Mission Hills. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, good morning. I love this topic. I came out of college in the early 80s, and there was a huge recession at the time, nothing like 2007, but nevertheless, we did not have the flexibility mode in our minds. We were grateful for whatever job we could find. And at the time, Hallmark was recruiting on college campuses, imagine that, and recruited me from New England to Kansas City. And I was grateful for any jobs, right? So we graduated with a studio art degree. You're not thinking you're the most employable person, even back in those days. But I think culture is a huge piece of it. So, you know, the fact that employers are talking about culture and presenting options to employees today is something that I did not enjoy in those days, because I would say it wasn't the perfect fit. And while I stayed for 5 years, and I stayed in my career path, but I've been a freelance person for the intervening 30-some years, it is important, I think, to offer people flexibility. And in that sense, I would say continuing to challenge them. But both the company could see a person outside of the original designation, and that the person, you know, continues to grow and challenge oneself or his or herself as a productive employee. And that goes to the engagement piece you were talking about.
Well, Leslie, thank you so much for that call. And Stephanie, that does bring us to the difference between attracting an employee and retaining an employee.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of these benefits, they're one and the same when it comes to attracting and retaining. And I think for some of the younger generations, you know, you were mentioning kind of the flashy things, the free lunches, the bring your dog to work, the things that really kind of the what I call shiny objects that, you know, that sound really exciting. But as this new generation is coming up and they're wanting stability, you know, other generations too across the board, once they really do find their career path, they want to be invested in. They want, you know, when someone says growth, I often ask, what does that mean to you? And learning opportunities. It's personal and professional growth. It's companies that take the time to say, hey, I'm going to set aside X amount for you each year to invest in personal and professional growth. Those mentorship opportunities, and not forgetting about people once they're in the job for 5, 10 years, circling back around and making sure that, you know, what their needs are being met. And maybe at a different point, maybe that flexibility to them means something different. And just having that pulse on your staff and being able to customize benefits from a flexibility, from a growth standpoint, I think it's the best way to
retain
employees.
It's so interesting, though, because it does seem new that people expect their workplaces to adapt to them and not the other way around.
It's because unemployment has been at an all-time low for such a long time, and it's not changing. It's, you know, the economy is strong right now, and there's that talent scarcity, you know, and you know, companies, you know, that work from home, working remotely, companies are having to reach outside even their geographic reach to be able to offer opportunities. Maybe it's the person two cities over because they can't find someone here that could work inside the office. So they're being forced for a variety of different reasons to offer benefits like this because it's just the market right now.
Tess, you know, earlier I asked you about values, and I think that you thought that I meant like, I believe in freedom and democracy, and therefore I want my company to have a stand on that issue. I guess what I mean is like what I value in my life as far as like where my job fits in with, say, family or seeing the world or whatever
absolutely.
Else.
I think that's huge with this generation.
Can you talk about that? Is that change part of why you would see people saying like, yes, but you need to be able to adapt to me too?
And we were talking before that the whole idea that, you know, previous generations would never go to work and assume that the work should accommodate that I got a new dog and I need to spend more time with my puppy. Whereas this generation and even millennials to a large extent assume that I got a new dog, I need more time, and I'm not even necessarily asking for time off. I'm telling you I need time off for this. So it's a complete shift. And I think that this generation is also expecting that the companies have a plan for them for their career growth, that monies have been set aside for professional development, that there is a mentor who's going to help me to get to the next step, and that the company is envisioning where I'm going to go up through the company.
Stephanie, are companies doing that? Is that a corresponding change that you're seeing?
You bet. There's definitely companies that are bringing on individuals, and you are assigned a mentor. We're seeing that. We're seeing companies that I'm kind of repeating myself, but they're setting aside, dollars for them to go to, whether it be a conference or, just ways to invest in their professional growth. Because depending on what it is and what profession that you're in, there's different things that are going to be important to you. But across the board, they want to know, am I going to be, continuously expanding my skills and making myself marketable? Because, they want to be sure that they're ready for the next step in their career.
Let's talk to Spencer. Spencer is calling us from Shawnee. And Spencer, I want you to start by telling us how old you are, because we are breaking this down by generation. What generation are you part of?
So I'm 25 years old. I'm right there on the edge of millennial and Gen Z. Though I seem to find myself agreeing more with younger people. A lot of my friends that are still in college that are in Gen Z, as far as the values that I look for in an employer.
Tell me more about that.
So I was a geologist in school. So the big money is in the oil fields. And I didn't really want to go there because it doesn't really align with my political ideologies. So I decided to go into environmental, which is, a little more in that scope. I ended up working for a company that does environmental remediation, but the bulk of their work is through construction inspections. And it seems that that's most of the work that I do, and I'm, kind of dissatisfied with that. All I see is us putting up, new $600,000, $700,000 homes, high-end apartment complexes and running machine on machine to achieve that. And I don't know, it doesn't
what
feel
is it that you
right
want
to
be
me.
Doing when you think about like what you thought you would be doing with this skill?
Well, what I thought would be doing would be like like groundwater remediation, Superfund cleanups, that kind of thing. Something that I feel might actually help the environment.
Yeah. And so you're feeling very value-driven in your work search.
Absolutely. I want to be satisfied. And because I'm not satisfied with how the work that we do, I'm also not engaged in the work. I feel that I don't care. I just drift day to day. And I really feel my employer is not getting the work that she could be getting out of me if she was putting me to task doing something that I'd like to do.
Well, Spencer, thank you for that call. I want to talk now to Jim. Jim is a baby boomer, and so we're going to hear maybe some contrast, maybe not, but a different take on some pieces of the conversation we've been having here about how different generations and their values, or maybe the economy and the way that's acting on their job market, how that affects what employers see the need to offer. Jim in Kansas City, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How about you?
I'm doing all right, thanks. I am 68 years old. I am a retired x-ray tech. And when I was in x-ray school back in 1980 and 82, I lived at the hospital that I was at school, where I went to school. And this is kind of referencing what one of your speakers was talking about, practically living on the Google campus. I was around people in healthcare 24 hours, 7 days a week, and that's all we ever talked about, and that's all I ever saw. And sometimes I would just have to leave the hospital and go for a walk downtown just so I could see people who weren't wearing white all the time. It got a little difficult, and I just felt like I felt like I just had to talk to someone who...
Just how's the weather? Not...
Yeah, just how's the weather? Just have a different kind of conversation. And for me, at least, it made school a little more difficult. And it was difficult enough as it was.
Jim, so is this kind of a cautionary tale for Generation Z as we are hearing that maybe... That workplaces are starting to cater to them by offering everything they need on the work campus, and that maybe there is this downside that will affect them in ways they don't even know about yet?
Well, you know, I mean, here, to me, if you are around the same people all the time and talk about the same things all the time, and you get to a point where you, everyone is thinking the same thing all the time, I think that it would stunt your personal growth. I mean, I make a point today, particularly now that I've got the time, I make a point to be around people who many in my family think are decidedly odd, and that's okay. I'm a little odd myself, but it kind of keeps me grounded. Well, it kind of keeps me grounded because these are people who are very, very intelligent, and they have a wide range of knowledge. So I can talk to them about almost anything, and I feel very stimulated by this.
Okay, Jim.
If I were around the same kind of people all the time, I wouldn't feel that stimulation.
Yeah, thank you so much for that call. And, you know, so we've talked to a millennial. We've talked to a baby boomer. They've brought some different perspectives in on this. Something that has not come up yet at all, which surprises me, is retirement as a benefit and as something that that would be an incentive for someone to sign on with a company, stay with the company. It's something I feel like baby boomers kind of had figured out. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe we will learn that we are wrong about that. But my generation and millennials, when it comes to retirement, it seems anecdotally that we are a little more like, la, 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 I can't hear you. Because we can barely figure out how to make finances work now, let alone when we retire. So I think there's also this thing where people, younger people, halfway assume the world might end before we get there. I know that's super morbid, but I mean, I think people are freaked out about like the fate of the globe at this point. So discuss, are you hearing about this? Are people just like, forget retirement, that's too far away, I don't even know what the world will be by then?
I'll jump in from a student perspective, and I would say that most students, it's not high on their list of concerns. It seems a long way off. And to be honest, they're probably more concerned about how am I going to pay off my student loans, and if I want to buy a house and pay off student loans and at some point start a family, I'm going to worry about those finances before I start worrying about retirement.
Stephanie, is that becoming more and more of an incentive, student debt repayment?
Absolutely. That's, you know, kind of a trend that we're starting to hear a lot about, and, you know, kind of that financial wellness trend. And that really means anything from your student loan relief programs. You know, there's a company here in town that we're working with that does that. They will, no matter what student loan amount you have, they will give you up to a certain amount to help you pay off your student loans, which
I want to talk to you about
awesome.
That company later.
Our time is up, but this has been super interesting. Stephanie Smith-Meyer of Morgan Hunter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Tess Serpernant of UMKC, thank you.
Thank you.
Keep talking about this on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Coming up, everything you ever wanted to know about fireflies but had no one to ask. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, finally, fireflies. They are twinkling in the night sky in Kansas City. And one of my favorite moments every summer is the first firefly sighting of the year. It came light this year, didn't it? That's one of my questions for Chris Kratzley. He's a biology professor joining us from Massachusetts, and he's part of a project called Firefly Watch. That's a citizen science project tracking major changes in the firefly population. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
So I feel like fireflies got a late start this year, at least around here. Do you know whether that's true? And if so, why?
Well, it's the same thing we observed here. So I would say that I think it is true. It may vary a little bit different parts of the country. But in general, what we think is happening is that fireflies are in some ways like plants. They're young, their offspring, their larvae are living in the soil, waiting to pupate, to undergo a transformation, much the way a caterpillar undergoes a transformation into a butterfly, and to then emerge as the fireflies that we see in the summertime. And we found that just as you can, for gardeners, just as you can track growing days based on temperatures and conditions in the spring, those same growing days seem to help us predict when fireflies emerge in the early summer. And so if you have cold days, as we did here in New England, and I'm guessing cold spring, and I'm guessing you did as well there, you're going to have fireflies emerging later.
There is some online speculation about overall a population decrease, people saying they're seeing fewer fireflies than they used to. Is that real?
Well, that's really why we began the Firefly Watch program, because we hear those same kind of anecdotal reports. And unfortunately, based on the life cycle of fireflies themselves, but also based on global population losses in all kinds of insects across the world, we have every reason to believe that that's happening with fireflies as well. But we have a relatively small population of firefly researchers out there to try to track this. And so we thought the best way to get real numbers that could speak to this question would be to enlist everyday folks who like going out and watching fireflies in their backyard to do some simple counts for us so that we can track over 10 years, over 20 years, real data as to how fireflies are changing. So it's not just the, you know, me watching the few populations that I can here in New England and, you know, my colleague in Georgia watching, you know, a few populations there, but that we can really get a larger picture of what's happening to fireflies. And so unfortunately, we think that that's absolutely the case. We'd love to attach some numbers to it. We'd love to also look at what some of the variables are that might be influencing that the most.
Okay, we're going to get back to that stuff, but let's back up and get some firefly basics. First of all, firefly or lightning bug, who says what?
So here in New England, we definitely say firefly. And I think as you head south and perhaps west from here as well, somewhere it transitions to lightning bug. I don't know exactly where, but that's been my observation in terms of meeting people and talking to them about the patterns. Certainly firefly is a New England northeastern term more often, and lightning bug seems to be a more southern and southwestern term, I guess.
And then the Midwest would just be like a free for all.
Perhaps you could tell me better than I know for sure.
I think so. I grew up saying lightning bug, and at some point I switched, and I don't even know when or how it happened. But I asked on Twitter this same question, and it ignited a true debate, like a vicious debate along the lines of cake versus pie, like that kind of debate.
I should say that neither of them is a particularly apt term, given that they're definitely not flies, and in biological terms they're not what we think of as the true bugs. They are insects, but in entomological terms there's a group that we consider the true bugs. They are in fact beetles, and so perhaps we need to settle the debate and coin a new term. Whether it be lightning beetle or fire beetle, I don't know, but that would be a more appropriate name.
You're blowing my mind right now.
Well, it's the other thing that we like to let people know is that we call them by one or two names, depending, but they really are many, many different species of fireflies. In North America, there's probably upwards of 200 species and over 2,000 species worldwide. And so right now we just have this one or two different names, and I guess different names in other languages as well, but for what amounts to many, many different species of bioluminescent beetles.
How do they light up? How does that work?
Well, the bioluminescence is a chemical reaction. And so the fireflies have specialized lanterns, and these lanterns in different forms occur both in the larvae and in the adult, and those are organs that have tissues in them, special cellular tissues that contain these chemicals. The chemicals are luciferin.
Did you say their organs are lanterns?
That's what we call them because they light up, but but they're made of cells and tissue just like any other internal organ. But we call them the lanterns of the fireflies because they're the parts that illuminate. They're the parts that illuminate when this enzyme luciferase binds to the substrate luciferin, the chemical luciferin, in the presence of a chemical form of cellular energy that people might remember from their high school biology, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and in the presence of oxygen. And so fireflies are able to light up through this chemical reaction that produces no heat. It's highly efficient, but it does use their cellular energy.
And why do they light up?
The oxygen. Well, that's a good question. And if we look at that question from an evolutionary perspective, we have to go way back and look not just at fireflies or what we call the Lampyridae beetles, the family Lampyridae within the beetles, but they're even their closest relatives. And what we seem to see is that the earliest evolution of bioluminescence may have been in the larvae. Again, what we think of as glowworms in everyday terminology. You might see those in the soil more often, sometime in the spring on a rainy day, but sometimes in the summer as well. And those glowworm larvae that live in the soil, we think evolved that bioluminescence as a way to defend themselves from predators. They had a defensive mechanism that, again, is pretty ubiquitous across the fireflies, a chemical defense in the form of a toxin or a group of toxins we call leucobufagins, and perhaps some other toxins as well. And we think that the glows were a warning to predators, just like the bright colors of a poisonous snake or the black and yellow stripes in stinging bees and hornets, a warning to potential predators that they have this chemical defense. Particularly a warning that would work in the dark environment of the soil, the dark environment of leaf litter and the forest understory where these larvae are living.
You know, can I jump in and say I was watching Curious George with my son, so a very reputable source for scientific information. And in it, the man with the yellow hat tells his pet monkey that fireflies light up to remind us that they taste bad. How accurate is that?
Well, that's exactly the story I was saying, but of course the man in the yellow hat said it much more eloquently, which is that we think that that's how it evolved at first in the larvae, and we think that that's certainly as adult fireflies began to evolve with lanterns as well to light up. We think that it defended them, and there's a lot of reason to believe that it protects them against potential predators like bats. We've done some research, and others have done research to show that that bats are deterred by the firefly flashes, and that they learn to be deterred by the firefly flashes because of the bad taste of the fireflies.
I hate to hurry you along, but we're short on time, and I have more questions. So now we're going to do, can we call this a lightning run? No pun intended.
Yes, absolutely.
Why do some lawns get more than others?
Well, some lawns get more than others because predominantly of the soil conditions. Remember that adult fireflies that we see and enjoy are around for only a few weeks each summer based on their populations. And then the rest of the year, it's their larvae living in the soil. And so you need moist soil conditions. You need soil conditions that are rich with nutrients,
It's about the larvae more than the flying flies.
Absolutely. Now, there are things that we can do that would disrupt the adults as well. If we mow our lawns too close, the adults will dry out and die.
Okay, gotcha. Remember, lightning round. Do they have a home base? Are the flies in my backyard one night the same as the ones the next night?
Yes, most likely. They are attracted to each other. I need to point out that this is actually a courtship dance that they're involved in. Although the light, the flashes evolved initially to protect them from predators, most of the flashing that we're seeing now in adults is actually males trying to communicate with and attract females. And so that's what they're using it for in adults now, predominantly.
Okay. And last question. What kinds of things do you want observers on the street to be paying attention to and reporting back to you for Firefly Watch?
We'd love to know, are you seeing them? How many of them are you seeing? And because they're using these flashes to signal to mates, they actually have different flash patterns based on their species. And so you can learn to tell them apart and see how many different species are out there by how many different flash patterns you're observing. So
this sounds really fun, and I'm not even being sarcastic right now, but I do have to say goodbye. Chris Kratzley, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Professor of biology at Pittsburgh State in Massachusetts. That's what Chris does. He's involved with Mass Audubon's Firefly Watch. And you can still share pictures of fireflies. I know they're hard to get on Twitter. I am at Gina KCUR, and the show is at KCUR CST, produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, Chris Young, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.